So yes, this is me. We want to talk about doing some sort of symmetry classification of Z2 quantum spin liquids by looking at fractional quantum numbers for the fractional excitations in that theory. So I'll start by reviewing what we mean by fractional excitations. Classic approach for studying how to classify theories with fractional excitations called the projective symmetry group due to Wen. Talk about more generally Z2 topological order, which is just the topological order of the toric code. I realize that there's a distinction to be made there, but I'm not an expert in that. So when you see me say that, I just mean topological order of the toric code. And then look at the fractional quantum numbers that can appear with that topological order and how that can lead to a symmetry classification. So a lot of the inspiration comes from Wen's paper on the projective symmetry group from 2001. This paper by Ku and Wen from 2009 has very similar thinking to what I will be saying in some respects. Some of our results appear to be similar to something that Kataev said in his long 2006 paper, although I will admit that I don't understand what he said, so I can't vouch for it. And this work is related to the notion of symmetry-enriched topological order. You could take this to be a special case of that, as introduced by Wen and his collaborators. And recently, Ying Ran, for example, has also written a paper that talks in this direction. And most of this is going to be pretty basic. So if I'm going too slowly, I guess you should tell me to speed up. So what do I mean by fractional excitations? I mean that there might be some system in which I put in a physical excitation like an electron, and it appears to split up into some fractional excitation that is sort of the dynamically relevant degree of freedom, say. The classic example is the fractional quantum Hall effect, for example, a Laughlin state where an electron might split into three or five or something quasiparticles in a spin liquid, spin a half spin liquid on an even by even lattice or something like that. All the physical states in the spectrum would be integer spin, but there's the possibility to have half integer excitations dynamically. And this sort of thing is associated with what goes by the name of topological order. So just topological order really briefly. The classic characteristic is that on different manifolds with different topologies, you might get a different ground state degeneracy. And if you look at it more carefully, there may be some non-trivial statistics among the excitations, and you can derive typically how the ground state degeneracy works from that. And statistics are associated with braiding. I like this picture by Da Vinci, wherein you can see that he spent a lot of time on the braids and not very much time on the faces, and so on. Anyway. Okay, so another important property, which is what's really the most relevant part of topological order for this talk, is the fusion rules. So, for example, if I have in my spin liquid, I have my spin a half excitations, and I make a bound state of them, I will get some set of possible outcomes, but they will all be integer spin. And so those will be physical states. So this is taking the fractionalization and putting it backward, identifying how to get the physical states from the fractional excitations. Whereas if I fuse a fractional state with a physical state, I get some other set of possible fractional outcomes. And since I'll be talking about quantum numbers, here we can think of the fractional quantum numbers being spin a half, and this just follows the usual rule for angular momentum addition. A fancy term that we use for this is superselection sectors. We call this the physical or the trivial or the vacuum superselection sector, and this fractional or non-trivial. And just to go back to the quantum numbers, we have integer spin and time reversible square to one on physical states, but for half odd spin, it will be different. Okay, so symmetry is the main topic. For topological order, there's no symmetry required. This is familiar. For example, the fractional quantum Hall. states, but we might be interested in a fractional quantum Hall state on a lattice. And people these days are talking about fractional churn insulators where there's no background magnetic field, but you could still get some topological order. People are studying this numerically and analytically. And of course, spin liquids would also have lattice symmetries in addition to the spin symmetry and the time reversal that I talked about before. So it's the quantum numbers under this sort of symmetries that I wanna examine. And I take a little bit of inspiration from the work that's been done on topological insulators. These are not topologically ordered in the usual sense of topological order, but they're free fermion systems that might have some symmetries, and they're topologically distinct in the presence of those symmetries. And so one can do a classification of topological insulators by symmetry. The image is supposed to indicate gapless edge states. Okay, so how does that classification go? Essentially, for the two basic symmetries of interest, time reversal and particle hole symmetry, there are some number of possible symmetry classes, and in any dimension, you can look at what the possible topological invariants are. And importantly, this isn't all the possible topological invariants that one could write down. For example, in, I believe, class A, in three dimensions, you could have what's called the Hopf invariant for your band structure, but that's not a stable property in that if I add more bands on, that may not remain a quantized number. That may be ambiguous. So what I want to do is, in the end, try to think about sort of stable distinctions, wherein I think of myself as saying I have some non-trivial state, and then maybe I want to stack in some trivial state and end up with the same thing I started with. Or I might want to put in some other non-trivial thing, and then I'll move. So if I have some integer class, then I would get 1 plus 2 equals 3, or something like that. Right. So I want to do something that's analogous to this with the fractional excitations. They're not going to be topological invariants, they'll be quantum numbers, but this is sort of inspirational, I think. So I just want to review the A classic approach for studying systems with fractionalization, where we introduce fractional degrees of freedom explicitly. For example, we can write an electron in terms of three fractional particles, or we can write a spin, a half, in terms of spin a half fermions, and then try to write down a theory that will describe these excitations, and that'll tell us about ground states, and try to study things that way. So depending on your favorite point of view, such a mean field description could generate for you a variational wave function by projection that might be useful numerically, or you might prefer to think about effective field theories where you think about an emergent gauge theory that comes into play. It's worth reviewing that a little bit. I'm going kind of fast. So a crucial point with this construction is that there's a redundancy introduced when you do this explicit fractionalization, focusing on the spin case. You start with an on-site spin, a half, it has two states. And then when you introduce spin a half fermions, you have the two states that you wanted and also two states you don't, one where the site is empty and one where the site is doubly occupied. And that redundancy comes along with an emergent gauge field, sort of perhaps the essence of gauge symmetry being this local redundancy. So maybe I want to call the gauge field G, and the theory should be invariant under appropriate gauge transformations. Not the gauge field, excuse me, the gauge transformation. And then if I want to think about a symmetry acting on these states, the action of the symmetry U for unitary, could also be enhanced by the action of a gauge field. Since physical states are equivalent under action of gauge field, if I transform under symmetry and then do a gauge transformation, I should get the same state. Okay, so this is not something that's unique to projective constructions, this is a very generic property at some level of quantum mechanics, not necessarily in terms of a gauge field, but just the fact that the wave function is redundant to an overall phase. And so for a long time, people have studied, at least formally, and also with some important applications, looking at how that affects the action of symmetry on states. So everyone's favorite and most familiar case is spin a half, where if I think of the physical symmetry as being really SO3 rotations of space, then this sort of representation shouldn't exist strictly, but it can as a projective representation. And so frequently we'd like to talk about spin a half and all spin as being representations of SU2. But for the purpose of this work anyway, we sort of want to think of rotations as being SO3, and then recognizing that SU2 being the double cover of SO3 is related to the fact that there are projective representations. The other most useful famous example is the magnetic translation group, where instead of having two orthogonal translations commuting, they commute only up to a phase. That would be this. And in this talk, I'll mostly write relations like that in the following way: put all the symmetry operations on one side of the equation, and any sort of interesting phases that might accumulate on the other side of the equation. So this, the fact that this sort of thing is possible, that translations may not commute on the single particle states of a fermion, for example, has important implications for the free fermion spectrum on a lattice, for example, and that's the famous Hofstadter butterfly over there, where as you vary the magnetic field, you get this interesting fractal structure that emerges. Okay. So, with that all as background, talk a little bit about projective symmetry group. In Wen's paper on this subject, he analyzed in great detail the case of square lattice symmetry. So that would include the translations that we talked about before. And here's that group relation that I showed before. And so all of these group relations that I'm showing evaluate to one in the symmetry group. They are all the identity operator. So there's the translations. There's time reversal, which squares to one. There's the reflections through the x through y equals 0, px, which squares to 1, through x equals y, which squares to 1, and then there's a C4 rotation, which can be generated by the reflections. And this is not quite a minimal set of generators. One doesn't really need to use ty here, but it's convenient because we know how to think about that. So I put it there. The program was to find the spin a half projective representations of this group. When we're finding representations, what we're doing is finding representations up to unitary equivalence, because in quantum mechanics, we don't care about the basis, so we should allow ourselves to change basis. And so it's only up to unitary equivalence. And so if we can do that, we'll have these different projective representations. Each one will be a distinct way that symmetry can act on the partons. We call them the fractional excitations that have been introduced, which are spin a half. Okay, so I don't want to go through the whole thing, obviously, but I just want to focus on a portion, which is to look at the point group plus time reversal. And what one sees here, I'm writing these little g's are supposed to be 2x2 matrices that represent the action of symmetry on the two-component fermion spinner. And if I'm looking at the point group and time reversal, there are four group relations that can be modified. If I'm thinking about Z2 spin liquids with a Z2 gauge field, they're modified up to a sign. That tau zero is supposed to be the identity matrix, 2x2. And so as you see, there are 2^4 possible modifications of these group relations. But if you work through it in detail, you see that, in fact, only 12 show up. And that's interesting. And here is the restriction that leads to that. You find that when fourfold rotations gives you a -1, you find that there's a relation between the rest of the relations, you could say. And so the question is, why does that happen? Oh, it's also worth noting that, so there are 12 realizations here, but within that there are 17 projective representations. Some of them have the same algebra. And so the question is, why is that? And the reason is that we're restricting to 2x2 theories. So if you allow yourself to work with larger representations, you would see more things. Now that's perhaps not useful for if you're trying to do a PSG analysis, the point is to try to write down something that you think is physically relevant and see what can happen there. You think that spin a half fermions are relevant, you write that down, you only get these 12 possibilities. But in principle, there are more. A way to get them is to take a tensor product of the things that have already been found. So for example, if I take a tensor product of, well, not sure I want to work through an example. But if I have one representation that, for example, has g squared equals minus 1, and I have another one that has g squared equals plus 1, and I take a tensor product of those representations, it'll have g squared equals minus 1. And so if I work through all of the different possibilities, I can build up all 16 possibilities out of the existing 12 representations.
But a standard representation would be like 4x4 matrix.
Yeah, 4x4 at least, or potentially very large. Right. Okay, so not that this is a practical thing, just that it's easy to see how one can get there.
So all those T actually is a gate transformation you need to perform after each signature transformation.
That's right.
I see. So this gate transformation shows up that it's
algebra. Yeah, exactly. Okay. So then this motivates us to think about the general case. Suppose that I allowed myself to think of arbitrary, you know, in a sort of an effective field theory point of view, suppose I allow myself to think of a system that has arbitrary representations in its spectrum. What will those look like? Okay. So that's a little bit of introduction. Okay. Excuse me. Moving on to Z2 topological order. This is just to introduce the system that I'm going to be talking about. The superselection sectors, which is terminology that I introduced before, or in other words, the different quasi-particle types. There's the physical states, which I'm drawing as empty. There's what's called E, or charge excitations, magnetic excitations, or flux excitations, which are M's, which I'm drawing as red as opposed to blue, and then fermion, which is sometimes called epsilon, which I'm drawing as purple. And the important fusion rules that these are going to satisfy are that fusing any two of them gives a physical state, that's the Z2 character, and that fusing the E and the M give the fermion. Okay, and then it's not really important for this talk, but the braiding statistics, if you take any one of them around any of the other, you get minus 1, the E and the M are bosons under braiding, and the epsilon is fermion under braiding. Okay, I need a sip of water. Okay. For me, I'm not very good with a lot of the abstract reasoning. So for me, it's useful to think in terms of the toric code model, which is defined on a square lattice. And the point is that there are spin a half operators on each of the bonds, and the model is not built directly out of those, but out of appropriate products of them for around a vertex, which is the so-called star, for around a face, which is the so-called plaquette. And I will be, just for convention, associating these with the charge excitations and the other with the flux excitations. The whole theory is invariant under permutation of those labels. So it really is just a matter of convention, but I'll do that. And then the model, Hamiltonian, is the following. So for each of the stars, there's an energy cost if it has the wrong sign, and the same with each of the plaquettes. So with the conventional sign, we take the k's to be positive, And then each one of these A's should be one in the ground state to minimize the energy. And if it's minus one, then you have an excitation and so on. But it's also interesting to consider the case where these have the wrong sign, so to speak, where the K's are negative. And then there will be a background charge, if I think in terms of the original definition, in the ground state, or a background flux in the ground state. Right. And so this model, just to say, this model will not realize all of the possible symmetry classes that I'll talk about, but it'll realize a few of them, and it's instructive to think about it. Okay, so just to continue, the physical states each have even numbers of particles. One can see that by definition, I've said that the excitations have to fuse to the physical state, and I'm looking at physical states, so there must be even numbers of them. At a more practical level, if I flip a bond, if I flip a spin on a bond, I'll create two excitations. And then I could separate those by flipping more spins, and that leads to the notion of a string operator that connects the excitations. And then what do I think about the ground states? The ground states are eigenstates of closed string operators. Like I said, there's going to be either total background charge of zero or not zero, some uniform background flux or not. And what string operators do, well, I haven't argued it, but hopefully this is a little bit familiar. The string operators measure the flux inside them. So if the background flux is zero, this always evaluates to a positive, no, plus one. And if the background flux is minus one per plaquette, essentially pi flux per plaquette, then if this encloses an odd number of plaquettes, I get a minus one. And if it encloses an even number, I get a plus one. So the fact that these are eigenstates means that the string positions are not observable. So I can take a state like this that has two E particles in it, and I can act on it with this same closed loop, and the string will move, essentially, because this, I'm assuming, since these things are built out of spin flips square to one, so acting on this portion just kills it, acting on the other portion draws a new string, and maybe there's a minus sign, right? If there was a minus sign there, maybe that picks up a minus sign, but it's still the same state. Okay, so that's just the topological order that I'm going to be talking about. So now I want to talk about, fractional quantum numbers. I mean quantum numbers under the action of symmetry. So think about what symmetry does. I assume that the ground state is symmetric, has a uniform background flux and charge. Don't need to assume it, but there it is. That means that acting on the system with, say, a translation in the x direction by one unit will just move the particles in the strings. I said the strings are observable, so you may think, why do you have to move the string? I guess I'd say you don't have to, but you want to keep track of the signs that are showing up. That's sort of the important thing. So a nice convention is to just say, this action always moves the string, and then we'll keep track of signs that way. Okay, so if I look at how this works, there's the process again. There's the state that I'm starting with, and if I act on it with a couple of different things, one closed loop, that'll give me, say, a plus one in this case, always, plus some little what I call local operators, local translation operators, I'll get the state that I want. And the interpretation of that is that the action of the symmetry on this state localizes to the particles. Each particle carries along with it its own translation operator. That shouldn't be too surprising. That would just be, in a fermion theory, that would just be hopping from site to site, right? The translation is given by hopping everything, and each site has its own hopping operator that moves it. So that seems pretty straightforward. So this is symmetry localization, and you can also see that it's sort of a fractionalization of the symmetry operator due to the presence of the fractional quasi-particles. Okay. Here I'm going to make an assumption, which I didn't spell out very well, but I'll assume that all the quasi-particles are the same. They are in this model, and in general, one should be assuming that. So then the action of of Tx is essentially given by a Tx squared. There are site labels, but they should be, in the end, equivalent. And the way to build that out is to look at a group relation, which is supposed to be the identity operator, and then the two products should really be exactly the same. And so I get a square of something. And that something is, in fact, just a closed loop around a plaquette, which measures the background flux of plus or minus one. So, yeah.
Can you go one slide?
Sure.
Back, so here you say that your transition operator, you want to write this, the product of two transition operators acting
locally. The, yeah.
Right. But then the drawing on top, you also have this.
That one?
Sorry, the one.
This one.
Yeah, this one here.
So right.
I see how these two operators, these two transition operators,
yeah,
acting on each of the other particles correspond to moving.
Yeah.
But what about the closed loop?
Right. So the closed loop, I'm being a little sloppy. I drew it with two so that it would be one, so that nobody would ask. But in general, you can. This is some phase factor, and if you're careful, you can see that this phase factor factors over these two. It's a product of a sign that's associated with this particle and a sign that's associated with this particle. And so you want to dress this with an extra sign. For the most part, that those signs all tend to cancel when you look at group relations. So one can be more careful about this than we have.
And then the net result, you just said it, but I didn't understand. The net result is that if you are more careful.
So if you are more careful, then you get an expression like this, but where this fractional operator may have to carry some sign that depends on the position. Right. So it might be a minus one to the x plus y or something like that. Yeah.
So you say this loop seems not localized.
Right.
Somehow you can need a localized loop.
Right.
Right. A phase of loop.
Right. Right.
Each year and the
particle. Right. So I guess a more general argument would be to say something like the following. If I have some loop in the system that's stretching from one of the particles to the other one, you see there's sort of a doubled line there that's part of this loop. I can always deform that loop around so that it encloses an even number of background fluxes. Plus some little bit at the end, right? So the part that encloses an even number of background fluxes is just one, and I can ignore it, and I'm left with some little bit that acts just at the end.
But the price you pay is that the translation on each particle may have an explicit spatial dependence.
Yes, yes.
So you're paying that price, you can localize that.
That's right.
And if you don't have a background flux, then you would not need to worry about
that. Yeah, just because everything would just evaluate to one. So it would be boring. Right. Okay. So let's see. I don't remember how far I got in this. I want to consider group relations. That's what I was talking about earlier. The group relations should be the identity operator. So their action on each local quasi-particle should be identical. So it's just a square of something. I think I said that all. Which means that I can interpret, it should just be a plus or minus one because it's a square root of one. And I interpret it as a closed loop around a plaquette. And I know that that's plus or minus one also, so that's consistent. Okay. So we've seen that the Z2 character of the fusion rules shows up here. It says that all my group relations have to evaluate to plus or minus one. Of course, there's also a redundancy that comes from the fact that, now I'm skipping around a little bit. In here, you know, I defined it to be this spin flip, the local operator. But I could have defined the local operator to be minus this, as long as I did it consistently everywhere, so that in this expression I would always have one. So there's a sort of redundancy there. And also, if I multiply two of them, I don't have a picture for that. But if I multiply, say, Tx and Ty, then I could also multiply the result by a minus sign, and as long as I did that consistently everywhere, all those minus signs would cancel out. Okay. So why am I saying all this? And it'll come back later. Right. Okay. So now I get to the slide with a lot of equations on it. Here are all the group relations. I added in spin rotation. I wasn't talking about spin rotation before. It doesn't really matter, right? Just write down all the group relations of the group that you're interested in. And on the charge excitations, all those group relations have to evaluate to plus or minus one, whereas on the physical exploitations, they always have to evaluate to one.
So those are sigma on the right, all just plus minus one.
Yeah, so those are all just plus minus one. I should have put a little index under here, but yeah, that's right. And so this is the same sort of equation that you get when you do a PSG analysis. You see that you have all these gauge transformations that accompany the symmetry operations, and those, when you string them together in the appropriate group relations, you get plus or minus one for Z2 theory. Okay, and then one can go about, again, constructing representations of these things, but now instead of saying I want to focus on spin a half fermion representations, let me just say I could construct all representations. There would be a lot of them, so I won't actually do that, but in principle you could.
Suppose if you do that, whether those are signs all independent or there is a constraint.
These signs are all independent. Here they're all independent. It's not that it's entirely obvious, but if you work through it, you can see that that's the case.
There's no frustration.
Right.
And that's specific for the square bracket.
Well, so any group will have an appropriate set of generating relations that if you take them in appropriate combinations, you can get some non-redundant parameterization of this. With the square lattice, it's simple because I just write down these relations and those are all independent. With a more complicated group, maybe you'd have to think a little bit harder to get that parameterization, but such a parameterization will exist. So for example, if you had threefold rotations, you might be able to fiddle with the sign of the thing on the right, but then it would show up somewhere else.
So the consequence that the number of class always a 2 to the sum power.
Yes, the number of fractionalization classes in a Z2 theory like this is always 2 to some power. The power is the, I don't know the right mathematical terminology, something like a rank of the group or something like that. I don't know. Right. Okay. So another thing to say is that, again, like I was talking about before, I could construct representations of these and then take tensor product representations. And that would have like this. So suppose I have one and the other, I take tensor product. That would have the relation of, that would have the implication of multiplying the signs that show up on the right-hand side. And so there's a group structure on this. I multiply two of these classes together via tensor product, which is the same as fusion, essentially, although I'm thinking in terms of a theory space here rather than the physical fusion process. I'll get every other one. So there will be a generating set. For example, the generating set would be where the first one is just minus one, all the rest are plus one, and then so on down. And by taking appropriate tensor products of that generating set, I could get anything in this list. Those wouldn't be irreducible, obviously, the tensor product representations, but you could get them. Okay, so what does this all lead up to? There's a group structure. There's a notion of equivalence classes under redefining by a sign. This has a fancy name, which is called the second cohomology group of the symmetry group with coefficients in Z2. I don't really have a lot to say about that. As far as I'm concerned, that's the definition of this. I sort of derived some structure and it turns out to have a name. but I don't really know. I know there are deep things that can be said about it, but I don't really know them.
So the Z2 comes from the sigma as plus minus sign.
Yeah, so those are the, right, so it's the sigma, and it's also the fact that this redundancy, these coefficients are redundant by Z2, yes. Okay, so now I want to say one more thing about these, which is that, so I was talking about sort of a theory space fusion operation that gives me this group structure, but suppose I think about a physical fusion operation. I have two E particles, and let me assume for the moment that they have different classes as parameterized by these. Then what I'll get is some physical excitation that transforms non-trivially in this sense. It will transform in some projective representation rather than strict representation of the symmetry group. And that is bad by assumption. I'm assuming that this is the symmetry of the physical states strictly. So what this means is that while I could have different representations, different projective representations for the two particles that I'm fusing, I want to make sure that they have the same fractionalization class so that whatever ends up on the right-hand side here, whatever, however big the representation is, it has the trivial fractionalization class. And what this means is that there's only one fractionalization class at a time in a given system. And so this begins to say, now I can do a symmetry classification. I have something that distinguishes different physical systems. I can't just put them together arbitrarily.
So here you only consider the relation for this translation on the reflection on the E particle.
Yes.
You have not talked about the M and that epsilon yet.
That's right. I'm not gonna say much about them, but I will say a little bit. Yeah, that's right. But this is just for the E's. So this is fractionalization classes. This does not classify the whole structure yet. But it's not too hard to see that what one should do is do the same thing for the M particles. And so now I would say, well, I have a redundancy for redefining operators there and there. So I have a Z2 cross Z2 coefficient group, for example, parameterized by two sets of plus and minus ones. And then the last thing to figure out is what happens to the fermion. The fermion should be what happens when I fuse these two together. So I should take the group product of the two, but it doesn't quite work out that way. This is the one place where the braiding statistic shows up in this talk. If I do the C4 rotation, I've essentially braided one particle around the other particle, which brings in a minus one. So on that group relation, I'll need to add an extra minus one to figure this out. And I could start from any two, right? I could have started from the epsilon and the M, say, and figured out the E or whatever. Yeah.
So we'll say that there's a sign for the E particle and a sign for the M particle independent.
Right.
And basically, you can from that you can confirm the sign for the epsilon.
Exactly.
But you need to add additional contribution
due to statistics. Right. So if you take that and look backward, you see that this was all really easy because the E's and the M's were bosons. And if I had been dealing with something more complicated, then I would need to think harder about what I was doing and everything that I've just done. Yeah.
But there is no freedom in sigma twist. Sigma twist.
Right. So that's we take to be specified by the braiding rules of the theory. Yeah.
So you only have a total number of possibilities is the product of.
Yes. Right. So that's basically what we'd say. There is a slight subtlety in the counting because, as I said, the whole theory is invariant under switching the labels. So I'll need to mod out by a factor of two or something, right? So I have some large number squared divided by two, essentially. There's a little extra bit that you have to add on.
But do you have to do that? What I'm trying to say is that suppose you have a lattice.
Yes.
Say, my vertex and my parquet are really different. I mean, suppose in your particle model, there's the KE and KM,
right.
So all are different.
That's right.
Then if they're different, are they the same or different?
Well, I would say that if what I want to do is draw up a list of symmetry classes, it doesn't care where the E's and the M's were living originally. It just is a label that I'm applying to some theory. Yeah. If one cares about the counting, which frankly I don't really, but people tend to. So, yeah. Okay. Good. All right. So basically, just to follow up with what we're saying there, this appears to be the structure.
Yes.
Sure.
So in the slide, you have a lot of equations.
Mm-hmm.
And so this number of equations determine how many sigma e.
That's right. That's right.
But how do you know you have a right number of equations? You may list more relation, or you may have less relation. You know.
Yes.
How to determine? Yeah, the number of equations you list is just right. No,
right.
No less.
So I mean I've tried thinking about that, and that appears to be a problem that is too hard for me to solve. But I can look up, for example, the number of generators and relations that are needed to specify a given 2D space group in a book. And I will trust that the mathematician who did that did it correctly. And then I can write those down and work with that.
Okay. I see. Basically, it's rather, you need to find a defining relation
right.
which defines the space group.
Right.
And the minimal number of defining relations is the one to one.
Right. Right. So there's another approach, which is to take the idea that it's a cohomology group seriously and to work out the the cohomology group of some group. However it is that you go about doing that, there are various ways. This is essentially one way of doing it. And there are other possibilities where you don't need to say, these are the related, these are the generators I'm using, and these are the relations, right? It's a general thing. But yeah, it's a good question. Okay, so if that's the structure, then at least nothing that I've said so far appears to put any restriction on the classes that could appear in principle. As we know, just to review, in the PSG, there is a restriction that we put in by assumption that we want to have a simple theory to work with in the first place. And that restricts some of these because some of these classes only have large dimensional projective representations. So we sort of can throw those out by assumption. And there may be other restrictions, which would have to be some, again, some sort of, have some basis in physics or what we're trying to do. Okay, so I'm sorry this talk is a little short, but I hope that's okay. Anyway, this is what I've talked about. What do I mean by fractional excitations? What is the projective symmetry group? How can I generalize a projective symmetry group kind of reasoning to general Z2 topologically ordered states and classify sort of a general fractional excitation spectrum in those based on symmetry? And then here's a list of some open questions. There are obviously a number of things that one might want to generalize this to. So I only talked about an abelian theory, and we think it basically works for abelian theories, although we haven't worked out all the details, but we don't know how it would work in a non-abelian theory, if at all. If one fine-tunes the toric code model so that the coefficients of the two terms are the same, then there's an extra symmetry which has the effect of there's an extra translation symmetry which interchanges the stars and plaquettes of the model. What we've talked about here cannot deal with that, as far as I know, at all. So we'd like to figure out how to deal with that. So what Ying Ran did in the paper that I cited at the beginning, he claims to have a way to do that, for example. Back to the question of what are the restrictions on these classes. It may be the case that some of these classes can't be realized strictly in 2D. So one thing that has been proposed to us is that you couldn't have T squared equal minus 1 for both the charge and the flux strictly in 2D. The reasoning being something along the lines of they're bosons, but this T squared minus 1 sort of means that they have two-dimensional representations fundamentally, and if I were to condense one, I should get some sort of magnetically ordered state. And if I condense the other one, I should also get some magnetically ordered state, and I can't get any trivial state, apparently. So maybe this can't happen strictly in 2D, but there are examples that have been worked out recently in which this sort of thing happens on a 2D boundary of a 3D not topologically ordered system, so-called SPT phase. So it's possible that that restriction is correct and that this can only happen on a boundary rather than strictly in 2D, but we don't really know yet.
So the point is that maybe only a subset of your classification can be realized as a pure 2D theory.
Right, right.
But maybe if you relax, can you say, if I allow my 2D theory to be boundary of a 3D theory.
Exactly.
Do we know all of them can realize that?
No, we don't know.
You know that we
don't. No. No, I mean, all we've done is we've done this symmetry classification, and then we've started trying to think through, like, could it actually happen? But from the point of view of symmetry, it doesn't seem that there's anything that says it can't happen. There has to be some other input.
So that'd be really interesting. So which class you're classified can realize 2D theory?
Right.
Or which can realize a boundary of a 3D theory?
Right, and which possibly not at all?
Or
who knows?
The deep brain of a 4D theory or two brain bones.
Right. Okay.
Whether there's a reason to say that, maybe some of the class can never be realized as a any 2D, even with boundary. Whether there is no example.
Don't know any examples. But we haven't looked at all, thousands, tens of thousands of them. So, right. And then another thing that's of interest to me is whether we can generalize this to some sort of three-dimensional topological order. There's sort of an analogy between what we've done here, where we have this H2 showing up, and what people have done with 1D, not topologically ordered, but sort of topological insulator type systems where this H2 also shows up. The coefficient group is different, but it's still H2. And if you try to figure out what's similar about the two, in 1D, no topological order, what you're looking at is properties of end states that are interesting. And here we have fractional excitations at the ends of strings that are interesting. And so maybe that's the analogy. And maybe in 3D, we would look at sort of loops being described by an H3 corresponding to the fact that one can describe SPT phases in two-dimensional space by an H3 possible. And then the big question, which we don't really know still, is does this have any relevance for anything? But probably, we hope. So yeah, I guess that's about it.
So you've described possible classification of phases when
right.
you take into account symmetries. Now, when I think of phases, total number of phases on the square lattice was what, 2 to the 21
or something?
Right. So that's like a million. Or?
Oh, it's some large number. Yeah. I can calculate it. Yeah.
Okay. So maybe Nietzsche is so ugly, right? But the question, usually when I think about phases, I like to think of whatever survived in the infrared limit, mm-hmm. right, from far away. So mm-hmm. it seems that here the square lattice plays a role. And if you try the same for the hexagonal lattice, you're going to get a different classification. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So is there a way of extracting some properties of this classification that would be lattice independent? And that would allow me to look at the field theory limit of this?
Well, certainly the group relations that don't depend on the lattice, for example, the spin sure. rotation and the time reversal, don't really depend on what lattice you're on. Other than that, I don't know an answer to what it would mean to have something that was universal in the sense that it didn't rely on having this symmetry group, because it's all an analysis in terms of a symmetry group. But there may be such a thing.
In
I just.
Team, you would have this, the point group is enlarged, right?
Yeah.
So you still have that symmetry anymore.
Sure.
Think of this way. So.
Right. Well. So right. So even in the effective field theory, I have to have a large enough representation to represent the fact that I have this underlying symmetry group, for example. Right. Just because I'm looking at a continuum theory of a system doesn't mean that the symmetry isn't there, right?
Right.
Now, if I say...
In any, so the lattice breaks symmetries, right?
It breaks some symmetries. Doesn't
or
break...
make them discrete.
Sure.
And you take a rotation and a relation invariant.
Right.
And discrete
right.
symmetries. So maybe the continuum limit would have even a richer classification. Is that more phases?
It's possible. I would somehow assume that it would be less phases because it seems to be easy to generate lots of stuff when you have a discrete structure, and somehow when you have a continuous structure, things are more constrained. But I mean, I don't know the answer. That's just my expectation. Yeah.
You mentioned that the Torricelli model realizes some of those things.
Right.
Whether you have some example on what they realize. So.
Right. So I only had two parameters in my toric code model. These two. These could be either plus or minus one. So you'd say there could be four possibilities. But under relabeling E to M, you'd eliminate one. So you'd say this realizes three possibilities out of 2 to the 21.
But those phase, if you correspond to your...
Yeah.
Which phase?
Well, so those are the ones, I don't remember the details. The crucial one has to do with the magnetic translations, right? The background flux or not, and the background charge or not, if you're looking at the M's moving around.
So like a KE change the sign.
Right.
This epsilon E, TXTY may also change the sign.
I think the M one. Yeah, I think if KE changes sign, then it's the sigma M that changes sign.
Oh, I said if KM changes sign,
right?
Then
yeah,
it's
yeah.
epsilon E.
Right.
Okay, that's how they do it.
Right. Now, at least if
other things are all positive on the protocol model.
No, no. So is so so in at least one of the classes, you also modify this one. Yeah. Also a rotation, and possibly, I don't remember the details anymore, but one of possibly one of these two.
Yeah. But somehow they modify them together.
Yes. Yeah. So in this model, they're tied.
So do you know that for generic case, the representation is finite?
Yeah, there are finite dimensional representations for all of them. Yeah, so you can construct the representations. So you have this modified group algebra. It still defines a group, which you'd call the central extension, perhaps. And then you can construct representations of that group the way you would construct representations of the original group with the various theorems that go by the name of Schur for constructing representations and things. Yeah. So like if I look at the point group plus time reversal, they're all four-dimensional or less. For this,
So you end up with all the phases. Mm-hmm. That's one of the difference in the physical properties.
Yeah, good question. I don't really know. The presence of this background flux presumably has some physically measurable consequence on the motion of.
Maybe there's one thing I can say about. So one difficulty to probe this sign directly is that we cannot create this particle directly.
Right.
So what you can do is that we can create a pair of it.
Yeah.
And then there's an issue with that. We know each, so like E, may E carry some kind of a projective notation or point group.
Yeah.
But we cannot measure it directly. But however, there's one thing. If you create a pair for E, we know each E is a projective function. When you put this projective function together, it can only become certain subset of a Euler representation. Then by the study which Euler representation appear in a subset, you may get a selection rule.
Right.
It's kind of like you put a spin one together, you get a 0, 1, 2. Then you put the spin one half together, you get only 0 and 1. I say, if I do this neutron scattering for 2e, say, if you only get a total spin 0 and 1, then that's maybe a sign the fundamental object is a representation.
Right.
However, if you find a pair for e can produce a 0, 1, and a 2, then that's just, oh, maybe it's a 1, not. So there's some indirect thing. Actually, this is a very, very relevant, in a sense, I think some people study this, that if this E form a Dirac fermion, you can create a two spin line. And the two spin line may carry this kind of a very strange projection of the point group. Then a pair of E, this particle extension, as density for maturation, may have particular quantum number at the point group, they may couple to acoustic phona in the there's very special selection rules. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's one way to try to see. By probing the representation of a 2E, try to guess what is the representation of a single schema. Mm-hmm. I think generally that's kind of thing.
Yeah. At a simpler level, one can say that if you're in a class that doesn't admit 1D representations but only larger, then you would expect the spectrum to be degenerate, and you can sort of predict the degeneracies of the spectrum of excitations that won't be unique in any way, but it will have some impact there. And another thing you can say is that at least with translations, if you study the ground state quantum numbers on lattices of different sizes, you get some characteristic, although not unique, pattern of quantum numbers for ground states. So I mean, there are some things, but we don't have any. We don't know anything that would specify it uniquely. That would, yeah. Yeah.
So you mentioned that there's roughly 2 to 21.
Right.
Yeah. I wonder if there's maybe identify or kill a few of the classes by the way that you put the system on 2D with different class on two sides, and there's one D boundary, and then see whether there's no trivial states.
Right.
Edge states.
Right. Yeah, it seems like there should be something to be done there. I agree. If you have that boundary, you're going to lose some of the symmetry operators. So it's not clear how much of it will survive, but you would think that something would survive and have some implication for the boundary spectrum. Yeah, I agree.
More questions?
I have a couple of announcements. Well, the first one is, if there are no more questions, so Andrew will be here until tomorrow night, flying on
Thursday morning, yeah.
Like 5 in the morning.
Super early, yeah.
Okay, so until tomorrow night. I think your schedule is full for tomorrow afternoon.
Okay.
But not in the morning.
Okay.
The other thing is, I'm going to be having dinner with you, if that's fine with you,
yeah.
Around 6 p.m. now, in the bistro, if anybody wants to join. And finally, the tomorrow, there is a follow-up talk by Janet. Is that correct, Janet? At 10:30. So it's related with the subsequent word that's a bit. Yeah, related to this one.
Great.
So maybe let's thank Andrew again.